Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, feminist icon Gloria Steinem. She rose to prominence in the late 60s as a powerful voice for women's rights. 5 decades later, she's busy as ever as a writer, political activist, and organizer. Among Steinem's greatest strengths has always been her ability to take complicated ideas and communicate them simply, often in memorable quotes. And now she's compiled some of her best in a new book that shares the title with one of her most famous lines, "The truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off." Gloria Steinem joined me from New York. Gloria Steinem, it's quite a title you've got for this book. Tell me about it.
Well, "The truth will set you free" is a quote from the Bible and has been used in countless ways. But during the Vietnam War, especially, and ever since, there's been the fact that, yes, the truth will set you free, but brace yourself because first it will piss you off. So I thought this was a kind of universal experience, especially in these political times.
Tell me about what brought you to the anger to the feminist movement in the first place.
Well, I acquired feminism by contagion and learning from Flo Kennedy and Shirley Chisholm and Bella Abzug. You know, there were lots of people already there. But I think my first understanding that this had to be a movement and could be a movement was in 1972, I think, when I was working for New York Magazine, and I went to cover a hearing on abortion, which was being held by an early feminist group as an alternative hearing, because in New York State, in the legislature, they were trying to decide whether to liberalize abortion laws. This was before Roe v. Wade, of course. And they had invited 14 men and one nun to testify.
Wow.
So a group of wonderful women in a church basement in the village said, "Wait a minute, let's hear from women who have had this experience." It was the first time in my life that I had ever heard women standing up in public, saying something that only happened to women, taking it seriously, being willing to break the law and the pretense of conforming, and talk about real life. And I suddenly realized this was crazy. You know, if 1 in 3 American women at that point had needed an abortion at some time in her life, why was it illegal and dangerous? So that was the beginning. And it just made such sense of life in fundamental ways that it became kind of irresistible to proceed.
And you were actually one of those women who had had an abortion when you were quite young.
Yes, I was 22 and traveling through London on my way to India. It was illegal in England, but after a lot of desperation, I found in the equivalent of the Yellow Pages a man who said, yes, he would. In those days, if he signed saying wrongly that it was life-threatening, then you could have a legal abortion. So he said that he would sign on 2 conditions. If I promised him to do what I wanted to do with my life, and I didn't tell anyone his name. A wonderful man.
Were there any negative health repercussions?
No, not at all.
Good.
No, not at all. And you know, we forget that, say, in this country, our own North American country here, before Europeans showed up, Native American women knew very well how to control their fertility and decide when and whether to have children with herbs and abortifacients. It's patriarchal systems that control women's bodies in order to control birth and how many workers, how many soldiers, what race, what caste, as in India, that have made this perfectly natural fact that we all get to, men and women, get to make decisions about our own physical selves. It's really the basis of democracy.
And can you believe that now, all these years later, in 2019, we are fighting the same battles all over again?
Well, I can believe it because, for two reasons. One, it is the fundamental battle. It is the first step in every hierarchy. When Hitler was establishing National Socialism, and he campaigned against the women's movement and what was then what we would have called the gay rights movement, with Kinder, Kirche, Kuchen, children, kitchen, church for women. And the first thing he did was to padlock the family planning clinics and declare abortion a crime against the state, with the death penalty for doctors and prison for women who then in prison could be compelled to have children. So, you know, we don't learn in political science exactly the origins of the first step in hierarchy, but that seems to be it in most countries.
You say that the fight for reproductive rights isn't just about women's rights. It's about racism as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In order to perpetuate a racist system, you have to keep races separate, which means controlling reproduction. Certainly in the earlier years of this country's life, the greatest crime and the excuse for lynching, for instance, was a black man who even said hello to or looked at any way or had the most free will relationship with a white woman. That was the major excuse for lynching. Black women, they are more likely to be exploited. I remember going to see Fannie Lou Hamer long ago, and she explained that she had been sterilized without her permission or knowledge when she went into a Mississippi hospital for some other reason. And her grandmother had had more than a dozen children.
Ah.
What was the difference between those two events? Farm equipment. So owners of the land no longer needed workers in Fannie Lou's time as they had in her grandmother's time. It's outrageous, but it's also fundamental, and that's why the issue keeps returning. You may have noticed that in current newspapers and online news, the white nationalists are mourning the fact that white women are not having enough children and that the white race is going to be eradicated. So there are groups that support Trump on no other issue but on being anti-abortion.
You know, I'd like you to explain what you mean when you write in the book, sometimes the most dangerous time comes after a victory. Tell us what you mean.
Well, I think I learned that lesson from domestic violence because, statistically speaking, the time in which a woman is most likely to be beaten or even killed is just before or just after she escapes. So she is escaping control, and the whole point is control. It seems to me that there are parallels for us in this country nationally now because for the first time in my long life, there's a kind of majority support for feminism, civil rights, gay marriage. What used to be relatively small or not so small, but anyway, not a majority support, is now a majority support. And those who depend on the old hierarchies can see that. The other thing is that the first generation of babies who are majority babies of color have already been born. So I've forgotten in how many years we will no longer be a majority white country,
right?
But pretty soon. And they can see that too. So the white nationalists, the people who are dependent on this old hierarchy, are in full revolt and panic because they are losing control, just like a man who has been trying to control a woman in the house. And I do think we forget that right after victory is a time of danger. After Obama's two victories, for instance, we relaxed too much. We thought, oh, good, he's there now. He's a good person. He can take care of things. But actually, we should have understood backlash.
So as you look at the Trump administration and what's happening in various areas, not only in relation to abortion, but the environment and foreign relations, and there is a third, at least, of the country who believes he is doing absolutely the right thing. Do you think that that's going to continue?
Well, it may continue, but they're not the majority. So we won the last election by 6 million votes. Hillary won 3 million more than Trump, and there were 3 million votes that went for other candidates. So we have the majority, and we have to express the majority. That's what democracy is all about. Voting isn't the most you can do, but it definitely is the least. And the Electoral College is being rejected by various states, as perhaps you know, that it was in the first instance only wanted by the slave states anyway. So it is, as lawyers say, the fruit of the poison tree. And that's the only reason that Trump is in the White House. So I believe there are now 14 or 15 states that have voted in their legislature to say, we will give our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote.
Yes.
And at a certain point, that makes the Electoral College irrelevant.
A quick break. When I come back, more from Gloria Steinem. Here's the rest of my conversation with Gloria Steinem. Her new book is titled, The Truth Will Set You Free, But First, It Will Piss You Off. So you've got angry people, this one-third of the country. They're not just all men. They're women as well. And what is it that's fueling that support for Donald Trump?
Well, I'm not trying to say I know the motives of everybody, but if you look at the statistics, first of all, 96% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
51% of white women voted for Donald Trump. They were married and not college educated for the most part. So it's probable that they were dependent on their husband's income and social identity, and were perhaps voting his interest as the same as their interest. You know, there are other issues, religion and abortion and so on, but I think voting for your husband's interest rather than your own is something that we understand. And, you know, the person who said the smartest thing about this was Harriet Tubman, when she was complimented for launching raids into the South and rescuing thousands of slaves who she helped lead out in dark of night into free parts of this country. When she was complimented for that, she often said, I could have freed thousands more if only they knew they were slaves. And I think that has a relevance to our voting situation.
You know, speaking of marriage and husbands, I think there were a great many people, your supporters all, who were surprised that you married. How old were you when you married, and why did you decide, after all, to marry?
Well, I was surprised too, I have to say. After 60 or after 70. the truth was that David Bale and I would have loved each other and would have been together anyway. He had problems because he was born in South Africa. He had come here with his children, who were actors, but that kind of visa had expired. And when we consulted with lawyers, they said, well, the one sure way to do this is to get married. And I thought, well, you know, we've spent 30 years changing the marriage laws, so I would no longer lose my name, my credit rating, my legal residence. The marriage laws are now quite equal. And on top of that, my friend Wilma Mankiller, the chief of the Cherokee Nation, where we were on our way in Oklahoma to go to the Cherokee National Reunion, offered us a Cherokee ceremony.
Ah.
So it seemed irresistible. But, you know, what's odd about it, I hope what I'm about to say makes sense. People, perfectly sensible people, would say to me, oh, you finally found the love of your life, as if that legal marriage meant that. Actually, for most people, I think there's not just one love of your life. There's more than one, and they're unique. And it was true. David had been married and had children and a wonderful wife. You know, it was so interesting to me that marriage still signaled singularity, even at my advanced age.
Tell me about how marriage changed your life.
Well, I don't think marriage per se changed my life, but I think David changed my life. And he, after 3 years, became very ill with a form of brain cancer.
Oh my.
And is no longer with us. And I have the reward of his very grown-up children as friends.
Oh, Gloria, I'm so sorry. That must have been very difficult. So now, in this era of Donald Trump, how are you focusing your energies?
Well, there are a number of centers of energy that I care about. The Women's Media Center is very important to me because it's a place where accuracy resides and where people in the media can find women experts on whatever the news of the day truly is. There are other groups doing global work and other kinds of work that I want to support and I feel very close to. I have a couple of book contracts that I probably have to live to 100 to complete. And it's just so interesting, you know, because you just wake up in the morning and see, you know, what's happening, and you kind of think, well, if we did this, maybe that would happen, and you get quite entranced and absorbed.
What about the Me Too movement? Do you think that's been a success?
Well, not a complete success, but it's been a huge majority visible movement, and it has been gradually developing since, in my observance anyway, the early 70s, when women who were working summer jobs from university, I think it was Cornell, named it sexual harassment because they were trying to describe what happened to them. Then Ms. Magazine did a cover story on sexual harassment, and even though we used puppets on the cover in order not to be too shocking, we were put off the newsstands in supermarkets because it was just, you know, too different for a woman's magazine to do that. Then Catherine McKinnon, our great legal scholar and tactician, wrote sexual harassment into sex discrimination law. So sexual harassment counted as sex discrimination, whether used against men or women. And the first three cases, legal cases, were brought all by black women, I think, against the government and a bank. And, you know, so you can see the gradual progress over time. Now it's a majority consciousness. And, of course, with the aid of the internet and our ability to talk to each other, it became global.
Now, I want to ask you today, is it a liability to be a woman running for president?
You know, I think it's both an advantage and a liability, depending where you look. 96% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton. That's enormous. And black women may be the single biggest voting bloc in this country. However, there are still, you know, we've already talked about this 51% of white women who voted for Trump, largely because, although there were a lot of different reasons, they were voting their husband's interests because they were dependent on their husbands. So it's going to take a while before we can look objectively at our candidates and see who the best person is. I also think that it might be a little harder for men to vote for a woman because they have not seen a woman in authority over them except as children. So they may feel regressed to childhood in a way by seeing a woman in power over them. I mean, you know, that's certainly not the only reason, but I think we probably won't have a fully egalitarian system until men are equal in the House and women are equal outside the House.
I want to ask you about something you said on my show back in 1999. We talked about Bill Clinton and your op-ed against his impeachment. You've said you would not write that now. Tell me why.
Well, I don't think, I mean, if we were going to impeach presidents for free will sexual relationships outside of marriage, there's hardly a president we wouldn't have impeached. I mean, you know, I think what's important is whether the relationship was free will or not. If it's free will, it's none of our business. If it isn't, then it's harassment and it needs to be dealt with. I think I would have explained that better, but I probably would have written the same piece in the end.
Do you think that Donald Trump will eventually be impeached?
I don't know. You know, really, it's Article 25 that is meant for a president who's incapacitated. I mean, that makes more sense because he is unable to read, to absorb. You know, I think, remember all the hundreds of psychiatrists and psychologists who, when he was first running, came forward to say he has classic narcissistic personality disorder. That means he's 100% predictable. He will follow any praise, whether it comes from Russia or Saudi Arabia or wherever, and he will respond with viciousness and hostility to any criticism. He's utterly predictable, and that is incapacitating. You know, it isn't, he really should be deposed for that reason. But an impeachment is almost too good for him. It treats him as if he's rational.
Gloria Steinem, how great to talk with you again.
Yes, thank you.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Levker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.